Well, by now you probably have some familiarity with Siri. And Siri is the voice on your Apple device, your iPhone, your iPad, whatever thing that you have. And you can ask Siri all kinds of things. You can ask her, you know, where is the closest Starbucks? And Siri will give you directions. You can say, hey, what time does the movie start? And Siri will give you, you know, the movie times. Well, some people have asked Siri some of life's most deep, meaningful questions. And the programmers at Apple have had some fun with their responses. So check out some of the things people have asked Siri. First, why did the chicken cross the road? In Siri's response, I'm not perspicacious about the peregrinations of poultry. Kind of along that same vein, people ask Siri, how much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? And her response, don't you have anything better to do? Well, some people got a little more, you know, deeper and philosophical in their questions. One person asked Siri, what is the meaning of life? I can't answer that. Now, Immanuel Kant is a philosopher, so that's why Kant is spelled the way it is. All right. Hopefully we'll get you with this one, though. The last one, someone asked Siri, Siri, am I fat? And Siri's response, honest, right? I prefer not to say. So, you know, we'll give her that. Well, this month, throughout November, we've been asking all kinds of questions in our Ask Anything series. And the main idea is questioning your faith strengthens your faith. And it's okay to ask God questions. When we look at Scripture, you know, we see people all throughout the Bible that are asking God questions, all kinds of questions. We see evidence of people being bold in their questions of God, seeking truth from God, and being honest in their relationship with God. And today our event is no exception. We're looking at Genesis chapter 18. We'll be starting in verse 16. If you're using the Bibles in the seats in front of you, it's page 14. Otherwise, we'll have the words on the screen behind me as well. Starting in verse 16. Then the men got up from their meal and looked out towards Sodom. As they left, Abraham went with them to send them on their way. Should I hide my plan from Abraham? The Lord asked. For Abraham will certainly become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth will be blessed through him. I have singled him out so that he will direct his sons and their families to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. So the Lord told Abraham, I have heard a great outcry from Sodom and Gomorrah because their sin is so flagrant. I'm going down to see if their actions are as wicked as I have heard. If not, I want to know. The other men turned and headed towards Sodom, but the Lord remained with Abraham. Now we're jumping into the middle of a story here in the book of Genesis. And some background information is helpful. If you read back in Genesis 12, where Abraham's story starts, God tells Abraham that he's going to be the father of a great nation, which would become the Israelites. And the purpose of that nation is to bless the other nations. So the whole point of God raising up the Israelite people is for the Israelites to be a blessing to everyone else, to the world. There's only one small problem. Abraham and Sarah have no children. Sarah is barren and unable to bear Abraham a son with which to fulfill the promise. So in chapter 16 of Genesis, Sarah gives her servant to Abraham for the two of them to conceive a son and to fast-track God's plan. And that plan works about as well as it would if you were to try that plan. Okay? Sarah not real happy with the results of that plan. In the first verse of our passage, verse 16, it says, some men got up from their meal. If you read earlier in chapter 18, the point of these men coming to Abraham and Sarah is to remind them that indeed a year from this time, Sarah will have a son. Even though she's old, even though she's way past the age of having children, she will give birth to a son, and that this through this son is the nation that God will rise up to bless the world. So that's where we pick up the story with these men who have told Abraham that God is going to keep his promise with the birth of a son, getting up and heading towards Sodom. And so we're then brought into God's kind of internal dialogue. Verse 17, God says, "Should I hide my plan from Abraham?" He then asserts what he told Abraham back in chapter 12, that he's going to make Abraham this great nation, bless them, blah, blah. Verse 20 and 21, though, foreshadow that all is not right in the world. God is hearing a great outcry from Sodom and Gomorrah because their sin is so flagrant. The term outcry here is a legal term. It arises from a people or a group of people being oppressed. And in this case, the sin being committed is so heavy, so flagrant, that justice is being demanded. It can be difficult to find a modern-day example of what was happening in Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, they do all kinds of lists, like top five cities to live in, and Sioux Falls often finds itself on those lists, or top 10 places to raise a family, or top 10 places to start a business. Well, they do other lists. They do, you know, top five worst places to raise a family, and the top five worst cities in our country. And I was really tempted to kind of show that list to kind of make a comparison, but then knowing my luck, I'd pick a spot where one of you is from, or, you know, one of you still has family, and you'd come up to me after service and say, you know, I really kind of like that place that you said is like Sodom. So we're just going to kind of bypass that. But imagine a place of lots and lots of crime, lots of abuse, kids are neglected, drug use is high, illicit stuff is happening, high unemployment, that kind of thing. A place where you would not want to go, wouldn't even want to pass through. A place that if you had to pass through, you would take the long way around to miss it altogether. This is Sodom. It's a place where there's no redeeming qualities that we can see. A place where it seems like everyone would be better if we just hit the reset button and started over. Back to verse 23 through 26. Abraham approached him, being God, and said, "Will you sweep away both the righteous and the wicked? Suppose you find 50 righteous people living there in the city. Will you still sweep it away and not spare it for their sakes? Surely you would not do such a thing, destroying the righteous along with the wicked. Why, you would be treating the righteous and the wicked exactly the same. Surely you wouldn't do that. Should not the judge of all the earth do what is right?" And the Lord replied, "If I find 50 righteous people in Sodom, I will spare the entire city for their sake." You see, back in verse 21, God says he's going to go down to Sodom to see if the reports that he's hearing about this vile place are in fact true. But Abraham knows what's up. This is God, for crying out loud. God isn't going down to see what's going on. God knows what's going on. God is going down there to take them out, to wipe the city off the face of the earth. He's going down to drop the hammer. And so Abraham approaches God, and this is his question. "Wait a minute. Should not the judge of all the earth do what is right? What if there are 50 righteous people within that city? It doesn't seem very godlike of you to wipe out an entire place if there are 50 righteous people. I mean, how just is that? How fair is that? What would that say about the God of the universe who wants to bless the world through the Israelite people if you're just going to wipe everyone out and ask questions later?" A couple things to take away from this first interaction between God and Abraham. And the first is Abraham's close relationship with God. I mean, this type of exchange, this type of conversation, this is the type of conversation you have with your best friend. If you're married, you maybe have this type of conversation with your spouse. I mean, there's complete honesty, there's complete openness, there's complete freedom. I mean, Abraham is not talking to God like God is the creator of the world. He's really beckoning to God's gracious, compassionate side and working him a little bit to get him to turn from that plan. It would be a mistake, though, on our part to assume that we can instantly achieve that type of relationship overnight with God without any work or effort on our part. As Pastor Doug has been saying throughout this series, faith is not something to search for. Faith is a byproduct of investigation and intellectual effort. And if you want, and if I want the type of faith that we see in the scriptures, it takes time, and it takes energy, and it takes effort to have that kind of relationship that Abraham has with God. The second thing interesting about this exchange is that Abraham is pleading for a people who, as a whole, probably deserve what they have coming. In some ways, the roles are flipped. God is taking the judgment side of things, and Abraham is pleading to God's merciful, gracious side. In our culture today, we see Christians maybe acting like the judgment side of things and having a hard time with that gracious, compassionate side of God's character. We know that God isn't offended by Abraham. In fact, he's open to Abraham's entire line of questioning. And I wonder if you and I need to exhibit the behavior that Abraham is exhibiting here when we see Sodom-like behavior in our world. Not being so quick to say, "Drop the hammer, God, they deserve it." But pleading for compassion and mercy and grace. Now, are we to simply ignore sin, pretending that it doesn't exist, or believe that God is okay with it? Of course not. But our faith motivates us to be for people, to be a people of grace who live by truth. And there is not a single person in this room this morning who is perfect. Each one of us deserves what God was going to do to the people of Sodom. Paul says it in Romans 3, there is no one that is perfect, no, not one. All have fallen short of God's standard. You and I deserve what was coming to Sodom. Because every one of us has sinned. Sex outside the context of marriage is sin, and so is lying. Murder is sin, and so is gossip. Now, obviously, those sins and others have different consequences here on this physical earth, but in the eyes of our Father, in the eyes of our Creator, all those are the same. They all violate His perfect plan. All of our sin is flagrant, it's disgusting, and it's worthy of judgment. And so the next time you or I are maybe tempted to play God when it comes to what we interpret as Sodom-like behavior, remember the part that Abraham plays in this story, arguing for grace and for time and for second chances. But it doesn't stop there with Abraham and God. Jump back to verse 27 and following. Then Abraham spoke again. "Since I have begun, let me speak further to my Lord, even though I am but dust and ashes. Suppose there are only 45 righteous people rather than 50. Will you destroy the whole city for lack of 5? And the Lord said, "I will not destroy it if I find 45 righteous people there." Abraham pressed his request further. "Suppose there are only 40. The Lord replied, "I will not destroy it for the sake of the 40. "Please don't be angry, my Lord," Abraham pleaded. "Let me speak. Suppose only 30 righteous people are found." And the Lord replied, "I will not destroy it if I find 30. Verse 31, Abraham said, "Since I have dared to speak to the Lord, let me continue. Suppose there are only 20. And the Lord replied, "Then I will not destroy it for the sake of the 20. Finally, Abraham said, "Lord, please don't be angry with me if I speak one more time. Suppose only 10 are found there." And the Lord replied, "Then I will not destroy it for the sake of the 10. When the Lord had finished his conversation with Abraham, he went on his way, and Abraham returned to his tent. Man, you got to love this text. It doesn't get any more real between someone in Scripture and between God than it does in this text. It's the back and forth, the openness, the honesty. A few comments here. First, to most of us, we probably think, you know what, Abraham, you're being kind of rude here. You're kind of being, not treating God with the respect, disrespectful. to him, to haggle about the price. But in the Middle Eastern culture, to the people who would have read this or heard this for the first time, completely normal. You never pay full price in that culture. It's like going to a garage sale. You would rarely pay full price at a garage sale, right? You're expected to barter, to banter a little bit. As crude or as weird as it sounds, that's what Abraham's doing. Okay, I got God at 50. How about 45? Maybe he'll go 40. Maybe he'll go lower. Related to that, this is Sodom, the worst place to live in the world at this time. And so Abraham is not some overly optimistic pie-in-the-sky type of person who's going to think, you know what, there probably are 50. Abraham knows there's a good shot there's not 50. So I need to kind of work God down to a number that makes sense, that I've got a shot with. Probably not going to be 50. Third, Abraham maintains his reverence of God. This is such a great depiction of what our prayer life could look like, or maybe should look like. You know, all throughout this series, we've been talking, you know, be honest with God, be open with God, ask questions of God. Those things are great and good to do, but don't forget who you're being open with and honest with and asking. It's the creator of the world. It's the founder of the universe. It's the person who puts spirit inside of each of us. This isn't Santa Claus that you're sitting on his lap and saying, boy, I'd really like to know the meaning of life. This is God, creator, God omnipotent, God omniscient, God who has always existed, who was and who will be. So have some reverence when we ask our questions. And so when you're praying to God, you could pray something like, you know what, God, you are awesome. You are holy. When I talk to you, I'm not even worthy to speak to you. And as long as you mean it, that's a great posture for prayer. Let's not turn that into a formula, though, for getting what we want. Well, I got to pray this way for God to hear what I'm asking. That's not what I'm saying. But Abraham maintains that reverence and that respect all throughout his questioning. Finally, this isn't some academic exercise for Abraham. This isn't some, you know, coffee shop chat or late night college room discussion. For Abraham, this is personal. It's profoundly personal because some of Abraham's relatives are living within Sodom's city limits. Specifically his nephew Lot and Lot's family. The people that God is setting out to destroy include Abraham's family, his flesh and blood. And Abraham knows that. That's why he's arguing for their behalf. You see, your ability and mine to extend grace to others grows the closer we are to that situation or issue. Simply put, if you or those that you love have been impacted by something or struggle with something, your capacity for grace or compassion in that issue or in that struggle is greater than those of us who maybe haven't struggled with that or had a loved one that has struggled with that. The farther you are, you or I are away from those situations or struggles, the less likely we are to extend grace. And it doesn't matter what it is. It could be health, it could be finances, it could be relationships, it could be work, it could be parenting, it could be divorce, it could be addiction. It doesn't matter what it is. But if you've been impacted by that issue, or you're someone that you love has been impacted by that issue, I'm willing to bet you have more grace for others in that issue. But if that issue is just a headline for you, just something off the news, we're more likely to be less gracious. We may notice some of these themes popping up again as we're going to move to the ask anything portion of the message. So I've chosen some of your questions to answer. If you didn't get answered today and hasn't been answered yet, there's still a couple weeks left in the month for Pastor Doug to get to them. I want to mention first, though, that I'm contractually obligated to say that my answers to the following questions are mine and mine alone, may not necessarily reflect the opinions of Hillcrest Church, her elders, or Pastor Doug. So there's your disclaimer, all right? First question. It's actually a series of questions. Are Christians to read books like Harry Potter or things with sorcerers and witchcraft? How about horoscopes? How about horror movies? All right. Harry Potter slash sorcery, those types of books, I would say maybe. I'll explain more in a moment. Horoscopes, I would say sure, but why? Okay? I put horoscopes in the same category that I put the fortune cookie when I get my after my Chinese meal. Okay? Is it wrong to read that? Of course not. But if I'm putting my faith into that little piece of paper, or thinking that the cosmic is going to somehow reveal my specific future, then yeah, it's wrong. Okay? Only God and God alone through his word can do that. Horror movies? No, probably not a good idea. The Harry Potter question makes me chuckle a bit, because when Pastor Doug and I were in seminary, the first Harry Potter movie came out to the theater. Now, we are that old, or getting that old. And we had a classmate in our class, in particular class, that was going to bring a bunch of middle and high school students to the movie as an outreach event. And that classmate shared that idea in our class, and then we had another classmate who could not believe that our classmate was going to do that. And so I forget the class, but we spent probably 40 minutes watching that ping pong match, between why it was a good idea and why it's not a good idea. Listen, Pastor Doug touched on witchcraft and sorcery last week as obviously not being good things, and they're not. I haven't read the Harry Potter books, not because they're necessarily bad, but it's just not a genre that I gravitate towards. But honestly, that material kind of falls into a bit of what I'd call a gray area. Now, those books do contain, sorcery and wizardry, and that stuff, can be bad. And yet those books and stories are about much more than just that activity within the book. Most any Disney movie, Aladdin, Little Mermaid, Frozen, all has a little bit of that, in it, where there's some magic happening or there's some suspension of disbelief that has to take place, okay? I mean, the prince and princess in Frozen, she does a little thing at the beginning. I can't do that. Can either of you do that? Okay? Now, I'm not saying that Disney's my barometer for what's acceptable in entertainment either. Okay? When it comes to entertainment, though, a good filter comes from Scripture, Philippians 4:8. Paul says, "Fix your thoughts on what is true and honorable and right and pure and lovely and admirable. Think about things that are excellent and worthy of praise." So whether it's Harry Potter or Frozen or some horror flick or some song on the radio or some band or some whatever, is it helping you and I think about things that are true, honorable, right, pure, lovely, and admirable? And here's the clicker. The things that I find to be praiseworthy and true and admirable might be different than the things that you find to be trustworthy and praiseworthy and admirable. And that's okay for you and I to maybe agree to disagree on some of that. Question 2. How much help is too much help? I want to help someone, but I don't want her to be dependent on me. It seems the more I give, the more it's expected. Isn't it better to teach this person to learn to live on a budget and not buy Starbucks? Listen, I just bought Starbucks for the heck of it, okay? So I'm just teasing. Hopefully this isn't about me. I do love my Starbucks, though. A good question, and one that for whatever reason, the time period between Thanksgiving and Christmas seems to just, jack the thermometer up on this and other types of questions. How do we help friends? How do we help family members? Should we? Do we? Can we? Here are some guidelines, at least from my perspective. First, I'm going to assume that you're in a position to help. If you're not, though, if you have your own financial issues, then by no means do not help out your friend or family member. But if you are in the position to help, we'll move on to the second thing. Secondly, realize that most of the time, dare I say all the time, but most of the time, helping someone with a financial need like this changes the relationship. Not all the time, but it can change the relationship. Dave Ramsey likes to say, if you're helping out a family member all the time, it changes Thanksgiving dinner. Thanksgiving's different with that context. Third, understand that if you're going to give the money to a friend or to a family member, it is a gift, not a loan. You need to give the money with the understanding that you're not going to be paid back. Your friend or family member may say that they're going to pay you back, and they may, and that would be super, but don't expect that. Give it as a gift. So if you can't afford to give that money away without it being paid back, then don't give it in the first place. Finally, you need to decide where the line is between, you know, one-time help or occasional help and continual help. If this person continues to make, you know, poor financial choices, or if this person is doing nothing to change their financial situation, then it would appear this person is shifting toward dependence on you. If you start showing up as a line item in their budget, you might have a problem, okay? If you've given money a couple of times to this person and they're coming to you again, you could say something like this. You know, before I help you this time, I would love for you and I to sit down and take a look at your budget. Or I'd love for you to, you know, meet with someone who's going to go through your budget. Is that an uncomfortable conversation to have? Absolutely. But is that situation going to get better, or is your situation going to get better without that conversation taking place? Nope. It doesn't have to be you. It can be somebody else that gets into that stuff, but that's what needs to take place for something better to happen. Same vicinity as that question is this one. Can you be too poor to serve on a mission trip? The short answer to that question is no. A church or mission group should not necessarily have a financial prerequisite for those who are able to participate in short-term mission work. I've led trips to Mexico, I've led trips to inner city LA, to a couple different reservations here in South Dakota, and we've never factored in, you know, a person's financial situation or a family's financial situation when deciding if people could attend a trip. We, of course, provided fundraisers and other opportunities for folks to raise those funds, but when it's all, you know, said and done, everything seemed to work out. Now, the longer answer, though, might be that there may be things in your own financial life where, you know, it might not be the best move for you to take a week or two off from work for a short-term missions trip. You know, if you know, we could just go really extreme here. If you have no money and you have a family or a spouse or just yourself and you're, you know, have nowhere to live and you're going to work or you're going on a missions trip, that might not be the wisest thing. You might say, well, God is calling me to Honduras or to Colombia or to wherever. And I'd say, yes, but God is also calling you to take care of your needs and your family. Let's take care of those first and then move on to that mission work. Last questions are actually two different perspectives or sides of kind of classic question. First perspective is this. I read Romans 14, which talks about not condescending others for decisions that we may not agree with. Does this mean that we should not help people to see when they make choices that are displeasing to God or are wrong in general? I understand that we shouldn't be condescending, but is it also wrong of us to correct or point out to people when their actions are wrong? Second perspective, are we to come to our own conclusions about happenings in today's world, or should there be some kind of guidance from the church? Are we afraid to offend and stay away from those topics to help others know Christ first? But where do we go from there? We are all sinners. No sin is greater than another. Just curious, where do we stand on tough topics? So it's this, you know, you have a friend or a family member behaving in a way that you think they would benefit from your advice, and when do you say something, when do you not? Or you come to this church and you're thinking, you know, what should Pastor Doug do in terms of teaching on tough topics, whether it's, you know, ISIS or homosexual rights or whatever the hot topic is within our culture, within our world. Well, let's start with the second perspective first. Should you come up with your own opinions on what's happening in the world, or should the church provide guidance and interpretation? Of course, the church should provide guidance and interpretation. But let me tell you what I think is meant by that question. When I think the person asking that question is, should the church provide guidance, they really mean, should the pulpit provide guidance? Or should Pastor Doug provide guidance? And that gets you off the hook, and me off the hook. But you're the church. Church isn't the pulpit. The church isn't the teaching ministry. Of course we're going to teach biblical truth from our from the platform. Of course, Pastor Doug is going to teach biblical truth and allow you and I to apply that truth to our day-to-day lives and to what we see happening in the world. But we would be amiss if that's where we stopped as a body of believers. So we hope that you are in relationship with each other through small groups or through classes or through studies, and you get to kind of work through those questions and through those issues in relationship with each other. I hope you take advantage of our serving opportunities, both within the church and outside the church's walls, so that you get to meet folks with a story or a perspective that's different than yours. Because remember, the closer we are to a situation, the more grace and compassion we have for that situation. Does that excuse that behavior or whatever? Of course not. And you're going to continue to hear truth from the pulpit. But that's not where it stops for you and I. We're the church. You're the church. And you and I have the responsibility to live that out day to day. How about that first question? When do we tell a family member or friend the truth? Whether it's some blatant sin that they are committing or a lifestyle decision like reading Harry Potter, I'm kidding, that we don't agree with. And when do we not say something? This is such sticky stuff, right? When do you say something to someone that you love or that you like or that you're in a relationship with, and when do you keep your mouth shut? It reminds me of a couple months ago, I heard the author of this book. The book is called Crucial Conversations. And he says the myth that you and I believe is that we often have to choose between keeping a friend or telling a friend the truth. So we see a friend or family member doing something that we don't quite agree with, and the myth that we buy into is either I have to tell them what they're doing is wrong, or I have to lose the friendship. And we don't conceive of a scenario where we can tell that person the truth and keep the relationship. So we either avoid telling our friend what we think is the truth in order to keep that relationship, or we tell our friend the truth, and in doing so, we lose that friend. Listen, it doesn't have to be either or. It's often the way that we tell our friend the truth where we lose the relationship. Granny goes on to say two things. The author says two things that you and I need to know when we're entering into a crucial conversation, whether it's with your boss or coworker, employee, friend, spouse, child, parent. The first thing is that you need to communicate to them that you care about their interest. The second thing you need to do is help them know that you care about them. Care about their interest, care about them. And the author says you've got about 30 seconds, the first 30 seconds of the conversation, to do that. The problem is that we put that on the back end of the conversation. We say, oh, you should be doing this, and you should be doing that, or I'm really worried about you, blah, 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 blah. Oh, by the way, I love you. And oh, by the way, you know I care about you. If you start with that back end of the conversation first, what it does is it takes the energy and it can disarm each of you a little bit. The tension, though, is knowing which types of conversations warrant that in the first place. And so three quick, things maybe to help us, when to have those and when not to. First is, if the conversation involves someone doing harm to themselves or others, then it's wise to have the conversation. Okay, so if your friend or family member is making choices or engaging in behavior that's harming themselves or harming their kids or harming the people around them, you need to say something to them. Okay? Pretty clear. Secondly, if the conversation involves someone who could live life better as a result of the conversation, again, choose your issue, work, marriage, parenting, finances, family stuff, relationships, whatever, then it's wise to have the conversation, but seriously remember that 30-second principle. Seriously remember that. Have the conversation, but wade into it. Don't cannonball into that one. Okay? Wade into it and help communicate your care for that person. Finally, if the conversation involves a legitimate difference of opinion, let it go until it comes up in the normal context of your friendship or relationship. Everyone has opinions, but you don't have a right to share all your opinions with us all the time. I realize that's difficult in our culture today, where a few clicks and send, you can broadcast whatever you want listen, you don't have the right to do that. I get that you have the freedom to do that. But you don't have the right to do that. But just keep it quiet. And when you're having coffee sometime, that your friend says, hey, can I read Harry Potter? We've been picking on poor Harry today. But, you know, yeah, let's have a conversation about that. But again, realize that you may agree to disagree on that. If it's a legitimate difference of opinion, let it be that. And let it come to your normal conversation or friendship as it comes up. It's the third Sunday of the month, which means that we give a second offering. It's called our benevolent offering. And we're going to do that a little bit differently today. Just on your way out, we'll have the guys at the back holding the plates. So you can just put that offering in the plates as you leave the worship center this morning. This offering goes to help people here in Hillcrest and throughout Sioux Falls with real needs. You know, we joke about the weather, we joke about how cold it is, but for some people, it's not a joke. And so this money, you know, helps keep heat on, it helps keep gas in the car, it helps keep food in the fridge, it goes to meet real needs. So as you give, just, you know, think about that. Now let me pray as we give this offering this morning. Father, I thank you so much for today. I thank you for this church. Thank you for the people here and just the freedom and the grace that we have to ask tough questions of you, to enter into real relationship with you. Thank you so much for Abraham and for his example of what a close relationship with you looks like, and also what it looks like to have honest questions. Father, I pray that we are a people who seek to live lives of grace and truth. And as we give this offering to you today, may you use it to meet real needs, both, you know, here at Hillcrest and throughout our community. We thank you so much for the privilege that we have to give to you today. It's your name we pray these things. Amen. So as you leave here today, again, you can put it in the plates. There's also the towers that you can put it in. Thank you for coming. You're dismissed.